This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
From the heart of London, this is Resonance 104.4 FM.
Winter is now spring. Goes from cold snaps to heat waves, or a month of rain overnight. Welcome to the new world.
Climate-driven extreme weather could suddenly change your life. You're about to hear from climate survivors in the USA and Canada. From stormy Louisiana to a Canadian Arctic town losing to the sea. Hey, I'm on summer break, but I couldn't help notice the climate casino is unloading like never before. We have an unreported global heat wave around the Northern Hemisphere, punctuated by zones of extreme rains and floods over and over again. Heat records extend from China to northern Finland. In America, CBS News reports a massive heat dome over half the country in the third week of June. As you know, seven states broke or tied high monthly records. When it went over 110 degrees, 43°C in Maryland, almost 500 people sought emergency care for heat-driven illness. There are hundreds of heat deaths in the United States. Overnight lows in Massachusetts were above 80 degrees, almost 27°C at night in New England. One day, New York City's heat index reached nearly 130 degrees Fahrenheit, 54°C. For millions in the South and East, the heat has been punctuated by storm after storm. Between July 1st and July 14th alone, there were 1,762 flash flood or flood warnings. South Korea just experienced its heaviest rain in 120 years of record keeping. Across the hot, dry forest of Canada, wildfire smoke has already reached Europe several times. Canada's capital, Ottawa, and its largest city, Toronto, had withering hot and polluted episodes. Not much reported in the West. Pakistan had weeks of heat beyond human limits. A place in China reached 46°C, 110 Fahrenheit, in their long-lasting heat dome, which extends into Japan, which itself set all kinds of records. It's been that hotter every day in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Iran is burning hot, 125.6 degrees Fahrenheit in Iraq, 52°C. It's like a ribbon of extra heat stretching across the top of Africa and running all the way to the Pacific, including Indonesia. Europe, as you know, has been wildly hot, right up into the UK. One expert rated the odds of the heat wave in the Western Mediterranean Sea at 1 billion to 1. Temperatures up to 48°C in Greece appeared again, 118 Fahrenheit in the shade. A new report projects extreme heat could lead up to 30,000 deaths a year in England and Wales by the 2070s. Scandinavia set dozens of new heat records right up into Lapland and the far north. On July 18th, heat historian Maximiliano Herrera reported 180 countries broke temperature records. I think we can call this a global heat wave. Beyond the numbers and the sad loss of loved ones to the heat, we have half a world of suffering people trying to cope every day.
This program from 2024 saw testimony from some of them.
We travel to burned-out Paradise, California, and drowned Vermont. If these stories don't move you, see a heart specialist. Warning, this is raw trauma. We start right now. Phoenix, Arizona is the hottest city in America. Last year, the county containing Phoenix recorded 645 heat deaths. That official tally is way below reality. Most of Arizona just declared another heat emergency, expecting temperatures to 113 degrees, a blistering 45°C, rare in early June. The same day, two extreme heat survivors from Arizona spoke at a national press event organized by Public Citizen and the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. The title was Climate Survivors Across the U.S. Tell Their Stories, Demand Fossil Fuel Polluters Be Held Accountable. You will hear several speakers from that event. We begin with Sizzling Tucson. Deborah and Patrice Parker are introduced by Quentin Scott of Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Then Patrice Parker, granddaughter, begins.
Next up, we have Deborah Parker and her granddaughter, Patrice Parker, from Arizona. Deborah is a retired nurse, has lived in Arizona since 1982. Her granddaughter, Patrice Parker, is 18 years old and a student and part-time cashier who spent her entire life in Arizona. Patrice has diabetes and asthma, making it incredibly scary to live through a deadly heat in Arizona. They can't leave the house at all when it gets into the high triple digits. The bills are astronomical because the high temperatures don't even come down at night, so they have to keep the AC on nonstop, starting to need it early and earlier every year. Deborah and Patrice, we look forward to hearing from you both.
My name is Patrice Parker. I am 18 and have many medical issues. As the weather gets hotter, I experience terrible flare-ups because of the excessive heat, and every year it gets worse. I have increased pain in my bones, joints, and muscles. My migraines are worse and more often. My fatigue and complete exhaustion, high heart rate, anxiety, and depression are always worse when it's summer because of the heat. The hot air makes it hard for me to breathe with my asthma. Think of standing in front of an oven when you open the doors and trying to take a deep breath. It hurts my lungs. My POTS worsens with increased heart rate, and I am dizzier, even drinking extra fluids. Because of the heat, I avoid going out during the day if possible, because even a little exercise in the heat makes me feel terrible. I think about the outside temperatures when scheduling doctor's appointments and try to go early in the day when it is cooler. I can't walk outside unless it's in the evening and when it's dark, but even then it can be above 100 degrees at night. When it's over 110 outside, my depression worsens because I'm stuck inside. When we do go out during the summer, it takes time for the car to cool. The heat increases my heart rate. Even walking through the parking lot can be difficult due to the high temperatures and effects on my body. I work in retail and management doesn't let me deliver orders outside because it's not safe for me because of the heat. Just a few steps outside in the heat, my heart rate can rise above 160 easily. It's scary for me because it's getting hotter every year and the challenges I face are getting harder with every summer.
Thank you, Patrice. My name is Deborah Parker. I've lived in Arizona since 1982 when I moved here as a new RN. I've raised my family here, and although it's been hot back then, it's so much worse now. My daughter has chronic medical issues, and we have to be very aware when scheduling appointments or going out during the summer. We rarely wear shorts because the seats will burn the back of your legs. The metal on the seatbelt latch will burn your skin when it makes contact with you. The steering wheel is so hot, you need to have a cover or wear gloves, otherwise you risk burning your hands. Always, always have ice water, multiple bottles, because if you break down in your car, you have to have a plan to keep cool until assistance arrives. I'm getting older and I walk extra carefully when I'm in parking lots, because if you fall, the asphalt will burn your skin almost immediately. I use ice packs in the grandkids' car seats to prevent burns and pre-cool the car. When my other kids were little, I didn't worry about the extreme heat. Yeah, it was hot and I was careful, but this is so much worse. As we navigate our daily lives during summer, life slows down drastically. The heat makes every muscle and bone feel like it's on fire when you have chronic illnesses. Cardiac symptoms are exacerbated because of the increased heat. Migraines are more intense and frequent. Yes, almost everything is air conditioned, but the time it takes to cool the car before and after the drive and the walk through the parking lot is challenging when you have chronic medical issues compounded by the excessive heat. I can feel the heat from the parking lot through my shoes as I walk. You learn not to stop too long. We are still in the first week of June, and starting at the end of last month, I have received almost daily excessive heat warning alerts through my phone. We are driving to Phoenix today, and it's estimated and forecasted that it'll be 113. This is still the first week of June. This is crazy. You know, the joke is Arizona's heat is a dry heat. Sure, You know, envision standing in front of your oven and trying to take deep breaths and continue breathing as that heat's in your face. It's difficult. It's hard to carry on your usual activities. The increased heat affects my power bill as well. In the winter, I spend about $30 to $60 a month just to keep the house warm. In the summer, the bill easily exceeds $300, $400. And that's keeping the house at 79 degrees. It's not comfortable, but it's bearable. It's better than being outside. You know, every time the air conditioning kicks on, I think about the bill and just realize it's just going up and up every day. And I'm disabled and on a fixed income. The power bills are another stressor added to the challenges we already have. The high bills used to be just in August and September, but now it's June through October. There's just no relief from it. Day-to-day life has been altered and it's becoming so much worse. The future terrifies me. The oil and gas companies need to be held accountable. They have made record profits polluting our world as they knowingly cause climate change, and we pay the price every day as we suffer through the heat. Thank you.
You just heard from Deborah and Patrice Parker in Red Hot Tucson, Arizona. That's life in the new hot world. Learn and get used to it, or stop the heat. Climate action. Now from too hot in the U.S. Southwest to too hot and stormy on the Gulf Coast of Louisiana. Very little aid goes to those who need it most as they struggle for years. Rashida Ozani is a survivor of hurricanes, fires, tornadoes, and pollution on the U.S. Gulf Coast. She lived in the petrochemical town of Sulphur, Louisiana. Rashida tells it like it is in this June 6th U.S. press event.
Good afternoon, everyone. As he stated, I'm Rashida Sibley Ozan. What he did not mention is that I'm also a mom of six and a grandmother of one. I live in a small town in Louisiana called Sulphur. Just as it sounds, it smells like sulfur. It smells like rotten eggs. We smell chemicals all the time. But as many of you know, Louisiana's climate is prone to extreme weather events, particularly hurricanes, which bring devastating storms, heavy rainfall, and flooding that test our resilience every single day. Not only that, but we're dealing with rising sea level and coastal erosion. In 2020, in the midst of a global pandemic, we also had two major hurricanes to hit in Southwest Louisiana, Hurricane Laura and Hurricane Delta. Myself and my six children were displaced because of these hurricanes. We found ourselves homeless, living in from hotel to hotel, and at one point in my vehicle, not knowing where we were going to stay the night. We were eventually placed in a three-bedroom FEMA trailer. We stayed in that FEMA trailer for almost 2 years. During this time, there were other people in my community who needed assistance, who did not have the funding to provide themselves with safe shelter during a time where they didn't know they were going to be homeless, where they didn't know they weren't going to have food to feed their children. This is when I started the Vessel Project of Louisiana in 2020, not knowing that a few short weeks after that, we would be dealing with another major storm, Hurricane Delta. So Hurricanes Laura and Delta were only 6 weeks apart. People who didn't lose everything during Hurricane Laura lost everything during Hurricane Delta. This displaced more people. We had newly homeless. We had people who had never had to reach out for assistance before. They were scraping and scrapping, looking for ways to feed their children and ways to help their families survive. This is when we recognized that our community of Southwest Louisiana was a resource desert. There were not the proper resources in place for the abundance of people who now needed assistance. We reached out to agencies like FEMA, who only gave pennies to those of us who were not homeowners. All of this must stop. The agencies in place did not help those of us that were not white and wealthy. During this time, as Vessel Project was developing and I was continuing to help those families in need while being in need myself, there were also chemical explosions that were happening at the local facilities. But because we were in a shelter in place, the people who could not leave the community had to stay there in the presence of those chemical releases. We started connecting the dots and we looked at industrial pollution and how industrial pollution leads to the intensity of these hurricanes and storms that we were seeing in Southwest Louisiana and the way that they were coming back to back to back. A couple months after that, in February of 2021, we were hit with yet another devastating storm, Winter Storm Uri, that froze states like Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana. So those of us who were still trying to recover from two major hurricanes, now we found ourselves recovering from a winter freeze that left many without power or water for almost a week or more. When is enough going to be enough? When are we going to stop polluting these communities? These polluting facilities are releasing dangerous chemicals like methane and benzene into the air. These chemicals are warming our climate. The greenhouse gas emissions that are coming from these facilities are causing these climate-induced disasters. The climate-induced disasters are displacing people and families. We're climate survivors not because we want to be, because we have to be. And many times we hear the question of, why don't you leave the community? This is our home. This is where we are from. This is where my children were born and raised. This is where their friends are, their families are. This is where their ancestors have died. We don't have to leave. There's another side of Louisiana that many don't see, because many times when you hear about Louisiana, it's because of all of the storms that happen. The other side of Louisiana is that it is beautiful. It is sportsman's paradise. It is where 90% of the world's seafood come from the Gulf Coast. It is where you get music and culture, things like Zydeco, Mardi Gras parade, festivals, and carnivals. People come here to vacation, but we get to live here. We're going to continue to fight for our home. We shouldn't have to pay the price because of these storms that are constantly devastating our community, causing us to have to pick up and move. We are also seeing higher prices when it comes to paying our insurance. We're seeing higher prices when we're paying our electricity bill, our gas bills. That is unfair to us. It is high time that these polluters pay. If they're going to continue to come to our communities and pollute our air and our water and cause these climate-induced disasters to increase, they need to pay the price. And I'm not talking about the pennies that they pay when they have an explosion or a chemical leak. Those are pennies to them. I'm saying they need to mitigate what they've done. They need to make it better. It is high time that our government officials make these polluters pay. Polluters like Chevron, polluters like Citgo, polluters like Venture Global, Cheniere, Shell. They need to pay. When I walk out my back door, I can see over 14 petrochemical and other chemical polluting facilities. That's not right. But yet when I go to the whiter, wealthier side of town, you don't see the same image. We have been made a sacrifice because of our skin color, because we are Black, brown, indigenous, because we have low income. We're being treated less than, and enough is enough. We're calling on all of those elected officials to stand on the side of people, stand on the side of what's right, stand on the side of equity, stand on the side of justice. Make these polluters pay. Stop approving new fossil fuel infrastructure in our communities. It is time that we rebuild communities sustainably and resiliently so that we don't have to continue to pick ourselves up by the bootstraps. No one wakes up in the morning wanting to be resilient. We're resilient because we have to be. And it's time out. Thank you all so much for having me today. And there's.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
So much more I can say.
From Sulphur, Louisiana, that was Roishita Ozan. We travel now farthest north to the Arctic Sea, where more communities are struck by climate change. Daryl Tedjik is a resident of Tuktoyaktuk, a fishing village on the shores of the Arctic Ocean, at risk due to rising sea levels. Daryl is working on a documentary called Happening to Us about climate impacts in his community. This short presentation by Daryl was recorded in Ottawa at a press event on Parliament Hill, hours before the CEOs of Canada's giant fossil fuel companies spoke directly to the House of Commons Environment Committee. No one whose life was ruined by climate disasters will speak there. They will speak here. Here is Daryl Tedjik.
My name is Daryl in my language. So my impact of my community is like it's washing away from the ocean because we live on the coastal side of the Atlantic Ocean, and where I have a video, but I can't show it because the timing is so short for all of us. But in next few months, now we're going to release the full video of my video. So be look out for that. It's called Happening to Us in our community. And I've been down to Spain for climate change and other places as well in Canada, besides the side. And what I heard from scientists is from last year, Tuktoyaktuk is going to be washed away in 50 years if we don't do nothing right now. But there's been a little bit of stuff happening right now, like putting down riprap around community. And there's like a main island covering our harbor. And it's going to be washed away about 10 to 15 years. And it's going to affect our community and going to be washed away more faster. So want to spread awareness around the world with happening to our local community, and everyone knows each other there, and everyone knows what's going on. And after we're doing the video, everyone's seeing what's happening in our local community now. Everyone's like worried about their homes washing away into the ocean. Back in the day, we used to have like a little bit farther out, about 1 to 2 kilometers away from the shoreline. But now it's like buying people houses. The beach is buying the people's houses. But now everyone's want to move their house because they're scared of like it's going to be broken. And when it's broken and you won't have the money to fix it, and I don't know if whoever going to fix it or not. Everyone don't want to move their house because they're scared of that. And we're on a shoreline, and it's very scary watching where I grew up for all my life. I grew up in Tuktoyaktuk. I love that community. I want to try to help out much as I can before it washes away, and so on. Let my grandchildren and my in the future, I want to have my children where I grew up around and show them before it washes away. But nature is nature. But us, we're adapting, but we want to try slow it down a bit before it washes away. Because if Tuktoyaktuk washes away and we have no home, and where we're going to go next. But yeah, thank you for listening to me.
That was Daryl Tedjik from Tuktoyaktuk on the Arctic Ocean. More to come from extreme climate survivors in Canada. But first, we go to one of the deadliest wildfires in U.S. history. The 2018 Camp Fire burned down Paradise. Alan Myers is a survivor of the Camp Fire in Paradise, California, speaking here at the Climate Survivors Press event in Washington, D.C.
And thank you, everybody, for being here. As I've heard, you know, we are part of a group that we didn't necessarily sign up for. There are climate survivors around the country and around the world. I grew up in Paradise. My mom grew up in Paradise, a little sleepy mountain town of 28,000 in the foothills of the Sierras. And as a kid, you know, we were certain that Halloween would get rained out. You know, that was always a joke. We'd want to go, but we'd get rain. Well, on November 8th of 2018, there hadn't been any measurable rainfall for over 200 days. It was record low humidity, record high red flag wind event, and a spark from a mismanaged utility company, PG&E. Now, they may have been the spark, but the conditions were set long before by the fossil fuel industry, which created the conditions, which created the climate crisis. Hot, dry, windy conditions that took that spark and made it into the most costly disaster in the world for 2018. Billions of dollars in damages. PG&E pleaded guilty to 85 counts of manslaughter. Now, I'm curious about the other actors. PG&E might have been standing there with the match, but it was the fossil fuel industry that threw fuel on the fire. I lost my family's home, every home I ever played in as a kid, the schools that I went to, the hospital that I was born at, are all gone. There has been an erasure of my identity and my community's identity. Things that we would look for that would remind us of who we are and where we come from are gone. This is what is left of my family's home. This is a jar of ashes. Home that I grew up in. Home that I stood next to my mom as she passed away when I was 11. This is our culture and our identity that's been reduced to ashes. There are campfire survivors in every state in the country. These are climate refugees displaced within the United States. My parents were unable to rebuild. My stepmom now suffers from Parkinson's and post-traumatic stress disorder. My dad is a full-time caregiver. I still have friends that are living in garages, temporary living conditions, being bounced around, living out of their cars because they are unable to rebuild and have not found their feet. Now, PG&E has paid out for their lawsuit, but what about the role of the fossil fuel industry? They are absolutely in part responsible for this disaster and should be held accountable. And that's why we're here today, to make sure that our stories are heard and that they are made to be held accountable. Thank you.
Alan Myers, raised and burned out in Paradise. He just spoke at the press event organized by Public Citizen and Chesapeake Climate Action Network.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex broadcasts voices of climate survivors in the United States and Canada. Recorded in press events, June the 6th, 2024.
Next to Heather McKay, she is a hairstylist, mother, and grandmother who lost her home in the summer of 2023 wildfire in Kelowna, British Columbia. Here she is from Ottawa, outside the presentations to Parliament. From the outside, Heather McKay.
My name's Heather McKay. I'm from Kelowna, British Columbia. In August of last year, on the Thursday, the 17th of August, I was getting ready for work when I found out we were on evacuation alert. I left for work and I have yet to return home. On the next, no, that night actually, on my way home from work, by the time I crossed the bridge and to the road that I had to go on to get to our house, they just closed it. So I called my daughters and my husband and told them they needed to leave immediately. And if they could get me some clothes, that would be really great as well. So I drove down the highway a little further and found a gas station I could wait for my husband at. And my husband and our daughters packed up our kittens and a dog, and we all went in different directions. We stayed in three different places, homes, but we had to keep switching because it's hard to stay at one place too long to impose. We've found a place to rent finally in October, and we got our own place again. And so in the months since then, we consider it a second life. We have before the fire and after the fire. And it's a rush of emotions. I feel anxiety and depression. I feel guilt that I wasn't there to help my family. I feel heartbroken when I hear my daughters talk about how they wish they had some of their stuffies from when they're little, or their baby box, or how they'll never be able to use my wedding dress in their weddings. I feel embarrassed that I mourn material possessions, but I do. That was 49 years of curated things that was gone into 6 inches of ash. I miss our family dynamic in that home. I'll never get to rock my grandson to sleep in that chair again. The stairwell that I held my daughter as she experienced her first heartbreak. The deck where we used to sit and have our family activities. I can never have my grandmother's doilies at Christmas anymore. I had no idea that we'd be impacted for so long. It's just stuff, right? But it has severely impacted our family. And I worry. Our rental that we have currently is by the hospital. And I'm so grateful because I know they'll never let the fire get close to the hospital when they come again. And they will come. I worry about the life that my grandson will have. Will he be able to have a life in Canada? We are on fire. And I know we can never stop all the fires, the floods, but we can reduce them. And I think Canadians are deserving of a future. I think Canadians should not have to worry whether they're going to be having to evacuate for weeks, months. We should be able to leave in security. And so I came here to Ottawa to beg politicians to make a change. As a mother, as a Mi'kmaq, we need to cap emissions and we need to make some changes so that our children and our grandchildren can have a future. Thank you so much.
Heather McKay lost her home to wildfire in 2023. She spoke at an Ottawa press event June 6th.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Join your listener-supported radio station at resonancefm.com.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
It is alarming when a town burns down. Reminder, cities can burn too. The old town of Lytton, British Columbia, was setting national heat records day after day, absolute new high temperatures for all of Canada, until it suddenly burned. That was June 30th, 2021. Practically nothing has been rebuilt since. Megan Fandrich is a resident of Lytton. She is a parent, a neurodivergent writer, and author of Burning Sage, Poems from the Lytton Fire. We will hear from Megan at the Ottawa Press Conference June 6th, and then a reading of one of her poems.
Hi, everyone. My name is Megan, and I'm from Lytton. And I think most Canadians have heard of Lytton, definitely not before the fire. It's a tiny little village. It was a tiny little village, even tinier now. On June 30th, 2021, so almost 3 years ago, our town burned to the ground. And I think most people know that. They know about, you know, the moment of the fire. You can imagine running from the flames like I did, like most of my community did. You can imagine watching your town turn into a pillar of smoke that's big enough to be seen from space. You can imagine seeing that pillar and the black punctuations of smoke that come up as another car explodes, another propane tank, another house. For me, I didn't lose my house. It was saved by firefighters. I had to evacuate for a month, and then I went back. I'm a single parent, and my daughter had just turned 5 in time for the fire. And we went back to a burned up town. And there was that moment of the fire, right? When we think of climate disaster, yes, we think of that moment of the fire. We think of running from the flames. But for me, and for the other survivors, and for anyone who knows grief or loss or trauma, it is not just that moment. That is the moment when everything changes, when everything you trusted to be normal is gone. But you have to keep going. You have to keep surviving in the midst of trauma, in the midst of ongoing natural disasters that just kept buffeting Lytton. We had floods that washed out Highway 1 on each side of town. We had the worst snowfall in decades, and we were told that our roofs might collapse on us. And this, dealing with these kind of things in the middle of that intense trauma, and that intense trauma just kept going and going and going. And we couldn't even start healing with the reconstruction of our town. It's been 3 years, and there's, I think, 3 or 4 homes under construction now. That is not the reconstruction of the hundreds of homes that we lost. When I think about my experience being a single parent, trying to keep my daughter alive through trauma in a burned up town, when the closest grocery store, we had 2 that we lost in the fire, and now the closest grocery store is an hour away on a sketchy highway that is slowly falling into the river. Trying to keep her alive through the depths of the trauma and the grief and the loss. It is so much more than just that moment. So I came to Ottawa to share my story because I think that climate change isn't an abstract concept. It isn't something that will affect us one day. It is affecting me. It is affecting my daughter, who is still afraid of fire. It is affecting my entire community. And it's, again, not just that moment. We've lost so many people in the community because of suicide, overdose, illness aggravated by all of the stress and the trauma. It is ongoing. And it's not just Lytton. It's any of the, especially rural communities that are more likely to be affected. And I'm here to say that we need to do what we can. And if what we can do, one step that we can take that would have a phenomenal difference, is putting a very tangible cap on carbon emissions, something that actually makes a difference. We need to do it. There isn't a question about it. Because I am now, as I come out of the trauma, looking at my daughter and thinking, how is this going to affect her? She spent more than a third of her life in a burned up town. What's going to happen to her? What's going to happen to the generations after her? Especially if these disasters keep happening. Especially if there is never a respite. If you don't feel safe in your own home. And unfortunately, that us from Lytton, that's how we feel. We know how quickly it can be taken away. Thanks for listening.
A few months ago, Megan Fandrich read out one of her poems after the fire on CBC Radio. Here it is.
Would you mind reading one of the poems? We were going to get you to read 2. Which is about, my understanding, the second time you visited the ruins of the cafe. Can you tell me a little bit about that day, a little bit about this poem?
Yeah, I think this happened in
in the spring after the fire, so almost a full year later. And up until that point, like I said, I had just been really focusing on survival. And at first, we weren't even allowed on our properties. And then we were only allowed back with a security escort. And there were all of these rules and restrictions around just visiting the place, you know, the place I had raised my daughter in. Mm-hmm. And I think somehow being in that hard winter and with all of those, for me, like impossible events, like the ongoing, the natural disasters, just being a single parent in a burned up town. And it was all so impossible. And so then when I would hear like, oh, you can only access your property with this or with that, and these, all of these rules, it would be too much. And so I couldn't go at all until I had a friend come to visit. And she said that she would go down to the property with me. And we went together, and it was being there finally with someone that I felt really safe with, and just letting myself sit there on the property. And then, as you'll hear in the poem, that is when anger finally surfaced. That's when my anger, like, just, it just appeared really suddenly. And that was amazing to step out of this like victimization, or but not exactly victimization, but just this helplessness,
yeah,
of the trauma, of the change, of how impossible things were, and to step into that anger. It let me actually step into, I mean, as they say, like, but the 5 stages of grief, or the 7 stages of grief, or however many there are, but to actually step into that process finally. Like, when I stepped into the anger, I stepped into finally forward movement, where I was no longer helpless. I could actually step into this active emotion and be really mad and control, I don't know, the experience around me through my anger. And from there, step away from the anger and finally away from the trauma. Not that I will ever completely be away from the trauma. The fire will always be part of me and part of us, but to actually take control over my life again. And I think for me, this moment in the poem is a pivotal moment in that progression of the emotion.
Megan, at your leisure, I would love for you to read it for us.
It's called Two. The second time I visited my ruins was in the spring, 9 months after the fire. The dangerous walls still standing, the loose bricks more settled, the ash and debris the same. A friend climbed into the basement, pit of ashes, with a hand rake, sifted for hours, uncovering relics of my past. Broken sculpture, fractured china, rusted jewelry, embedded in pieces of shattered glass. I sat at the top, watched what she pulled out, feeling nothing except a dull curiosity. How a burned doorknob looks like a vase, or knitting needles crumble with touch, or only the ugliest dishes survive. Feeling dull curiosity, but no attachment to this excavation of life. She brought up jars, herb-infused salts, products I made in the kitchen a few days before the fire, the glass still intact, just scorched. She set them gently on the sidewalk beside me. And one by one, I smashed them.
That was Megan Fandrich reading a poem called Two from her new poetry collection. It's called Burning Sage, Poems from the Litten Fire, and it's out now. Megan joined me from New York City.
As recorded by CBC Radio. The alarming thing from so many climate stories, it takes years to recover, and some things are never recovered. You don't trust life anymore. A whiff of smoke or a strange noise and sleep won't come. Even kids are nervous after being dehomed by extreme events. New England gets hurricanes like Irene, some nor'easters, of course, and flat-out winds. But this mother and small business person never expected the flood to come to her town. Jenny Siebold is a survivor of the Great Vermont Flood of 2023 in Montpelier.
Next, I would like to bring up Jenny Siebold from Vermont, who owns Rebel Heart Collective, a Montpelier business severely damaged When the Winooski River flooded in July 2023, Jenny has lived in Vermont for over 22 years and opened her business, which sells home goods, clothing, books, and jewelry, 5 years ago. Jenny is a single mother of three and suffered more than $60,000 in damage due to the flooding, and her store was closed for more than 6 months while flood damage was repaired. Jenny, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been an emotional morning in my world. I'm Jenny Siebold, single mom of three kids. I live in Montpelier. I've lived here for over 20 years. And I started a business about 6 years ago with a lot of optimism and hope, and some beautiful clothing store that I put my whole heart and soul into renovating. And then a little while back, I bought a flower shop and moved that into my business. So I have clothes and flowers, and I love what I do, and I love being a part of my community. Last year, July 2024, July 11th, which is the same day that I founded my company, ironically, is the same day that the flood came through and filled up the shop and all of Montpelier. My shop was only 4 feet high. Some of the other shops were 7, 8, 9 feet high worth of floodwaters that came through. And it was devastating. And I'm still rebuilding. It's not stopped. It's hard. Every day I wake up and try to be as optimistic as possible to go forward. This is the way that I support my family. It's my sole income. My shops were closed for over 7 months. We just reopened in February in a very limited capacity. And there was no, you know, there's not a lot of money. FEMA doesn't help businesses. There's limited grants. There's, thank goodness I have some family support, because everything could have just fallen apart for me. I could have lost even more than I did. During those 7 months, I had to support my two kids who live with me. And one of them was launching off into the world, and I had to often wake up in the morning and decide, like, am I going to feed myself today, or am I going to send my kid off to pursue his dream? And he's worked so hard for his whole, you know, young adult life. And so oftentimes I would have an empty belly just to help him do what he needed to do. And it hasn't stopped. I'm open, but the economic liveliness has not returned to our town. Floodwaters don't just like go away and then you just like dry things out. You know, there was record temperatures after that. So then it was hot and everything had to get taken out. Otherwise it would mold. It's mind boggling. I would not wish this on my worst enemy. I had no idea I would watch these communities like Louisiana go through flooding or hurricanes. I had no comprehension what the actual impact is. It's gross. There's not to mention it was class 4 floodwater. So there was who knows what in the water. And we're just doing what we can as a community, banding together, getting it all out. But we had rashes and people had stomach bugs. People still have issues, health issues from exposure to all that. And yeah, it just continues to be really hard. And it feels like these communities are, we're like the band on the Titanic. Nobody wants to fix the ship that's going down, but they want all of these people to like just keep playing the music and bear the brunt. You know, people keep saying to me, you didn't do anything wrong. And I didn't. I didn't ask for a flood. None of us asked for this. But I feel like I did do something wrong. And just like, why can't I rebuild? Why can't I, you know, I'm still like applying for food stamps and like trying to just make ends meet. And yeah, and I'm just one person who has this story. And I don't know. I just it's unfair. It's unfair that it's all pushed onto the people, you know, like the speaker before said, I'm not a survivor because I want to be. It's just, it's the only option. I have no other option. I have to continue moving on for my family and for a community that I really hold dear. And yeah, that's my story. I'm trying to be optimistic and move ahead. And, but you know, there are good days and there are bad days, and I'm wealthy in optimism most days. So thanks for hearing me.
Jenny Siebold was flooded out in Vermont in 2023. Extreme rainfall events are striking all over the world. Just look at the Danube floods right now in Europe. They turn lives upside down for years afterwards. Somehow fire and floods can be related. One comes after the other. The interior of British Columbia is known for frightening wildfires, so Diana Boston was shocked when she had to run from the flood. Diana is a member of the Upper Nicola Band, the only Selix Okanagan First Nations community in the Nicola Valley in British Columbia. Her home was severely damaged in the 2021 flood of Merritt. Here is Diana Boston speaking in Ottawa June 6th.
Hi there. My name is Diana Boston, and I come from the interior of British Columbia, Merritt, British Columbia. In November of 2021, we went through what they called an atmospheric flood. November 15th, I woke up with my husband at 3 in the morning, sent him off to work. Then at 3:30, I happened to notice some flashing lights out the back window. And as I looked in the backyard, we have a school field there. Looked like an ice rink. So I went out the front yard. And I noticed this water going down our driveway. Water coming through our yard. So I went inside. I told my daughter, I said, hey, we're going to have to evacuate. And she said, for what? And I said, I think we're flooding. She said, no way. And she looked out her window. Our street was full of water. So we started packing up our dogs, our cat. We threw our rabbits and guinea pigs some food, hoping that they'd be okay. And we grabbed everything we thought we needed. And we took it all out to the truck. I remember walking out to the truck. The water was rushing so fast. I had to help my daughter walk to the truck. Got her in. I went to go behind the truck, but there was a garbage can blocking my way. I was so cold and the water was so high, I couldn't even get over the garbage can. I had to hold my truck and walk around the front end of it. When I got into my truck, water started flowing into it. We had to go. Like, there was no way around it. We had to leave. So we got to higher grounds. And then we went to my in-laws. And then we found out that it was the Coldwater River that had flooded from the Fraser Valley into the Nicola Valley. We didn't lose our home, thank God. But our neighbors did. Their whole entire house fell down. And then when we actually got to see our house, we have a 4.5-foot crawl space. It was full of water, not even just water, silt and mud and guck. Our basement had a water line of 6 inches. You could just see all the muck and all the silt and everything all over the floors. Couldn't even walk in there. It was like 2 inches of silt. So we did what we could. We saved what we could. We thought everything else would be okay, you know, it's a little bit of mud. And then all of a sudden they started the restoration. We lost a lot of stuff. Everything from my children's childhood, all gone. Every homemade Father's Day gift, gone. Whole gym workout system, gone. Whole basement, gone. I had antiques handed down to me from my granny. Those are gone. Can't get them back. Can't restore them. They're gone. My kids don't even have photos anymore. But we're trying to live as best we can. So we left Merritt because the whole city got evacuated due to a sewage backup from the flooding. So we went to Kamloops, and the three of us, three dogs and a cat, all stayed in a one-bedroom condo for 2 months. Three adults, three dogs and a cat, all in one condo. We made it work. We did the best we could. We continued to remotely work, remotely do school. My daughter just got back to school. In classroom schooling that September. Within 2 months, she's back to online learning in her grade 12 year. She didn't get to be with her friends. She didn't get to be with her peers. It was all through FaceTime. She lost a lot of her high school years. Not just the pandemic, but the flood. And guess what? She made it. She graduated. We had an in-person graduation. It's been 2.5 years now. We finally got a fence built. We actually have a real fence, not just pieces of random wood we found in the alleyway or anything. We have a fence. We still have to do some siding, as there's still silt stuck inside the house. So we still have to rebuild that. We still have a lot of yard work that we have to get done. And when it rains, we can't sleep. When you hear the rain on your windows, it's just, you think about that night. And I would never want anybody to go through that ever again. I've never, ever want to go through that again. And if I didn't have my daughter, I don't know if I could have done it. And my husband's 3 hours away at work. He can't come and help us. So we did the best we could. We're trying to live our life now. And her and I came to Ottawa because we're done. We need to put a cap on these emissions. We need to help this world. We need to have a greener, healthier future. Not for us, for the next generations. In my culture, we think 7 generations ahead. That's what we need to start doing. 7 generations. Can they live here? That's what we need to think about. Them, not us. So please, hear us out. And thank you for listening.
That was Diana Boston from British Columbia. So coast to coast and everywhere in between, global warming brings unstable weather and unnatural disasters over and over. My thanks to Public Citizen, the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and the Climate Action Network in Canada for bringing out these important voices from the climate front. Find links and more information in my show blog at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for including Radio EcoShock in your time and caring about our world.
My town is burning, never returning. Nowhere to go, no home. Old church, old school, old trees. In photographs, in my mind, in my mind.